Hello, grandkids. After a couple of week layoff, Ken, it was a little bit strange. You were under the weather.
Mm-hmm.
We recorded one a while ago, right before the bachelor party. And we have not come to you ever since.
Yeah, I guess it took a little preparation to get ready for the bachelor party that week, and we were probably both too busy there to get together.
Yeah, that was a little busy.
And then I would say, yeah, I got sick after that. I don't know if it was my immune system was compromised after that bachelor party weekend.
Well, you were one of the elite four to make it out to Dave and Buster's.
Oh, yeah.
After the bulk of the bachelor party. So maybe that's what did you in.
The final four, if yep. you will. Yeah.
The final four. You, my younger brother, and my neighbor Fred were still in the game.
Yeah.
Everybody else was in for a old nap.
One by one, they dropped off. Yeah. Of course, our friend Adam was the first to go because he has a family that he has to take care of, so
and pack for a vacation.
Yeah,
quote unquote.
Right, so he you know, had to get out early, and then you know, we started at actually a baseball game, I recall.
Yes, we did. Friday evening was the Pirates game. We could not have had, I had some good street food, always appreciated, burger, I think, very, I did like all the food truck names. They were very, a lot of them were Pittsburgh, inspired, because it's B-R-G-R, you know, so, yeah, Pittsburgher.
Very nice.
Yes, and then there was the Mac and Gold truck, too, which
that's
was
good.
Quite tasty.
I love a good pun, so, you know, I'm in on these as well. and we got to see the Pirates play. It was an interesting game.
Yeah, we got some extra innings. We got a victory, even better, Jordy Mercer with a walk-off single and or double. I can't remember if he actually needed to get the second. For the other gentleman to score.
Oh, yeah. I don't know.
You know, it's one or the other.
But, yeah, it was interesting. There's a lot of instant replay. There was, like, stuff that I saw that really confused me. But that's pretty much par for the course when I watch baseball. but, yeah, it was a fun night out.
And, even beers after at PNC Park were only $2.50 because we did not officially go to one of the River Town. We did not go to the River Town with an E brewery, but we did visit their Hall of Fame, which is part of PNC Park after the game. And it was $2.50 for one of their RT lagers, which. I would pay $2.50 for that beer anywhere, anytime.
Yeah, that's a great deal. I mean, you're not going to find, you know, cheaper. I don't think you could buy a Bud Light for that in most places.
Right.
Know? So that's that's a heck of a deal.
Right.
At the stadium.
Yeah, at the stadium. And they did have a nice beer selection there. Like, I am increasingly finding that at all sporting venues, which is kind of nice because I don't feel as bad, like, when I know that it's actually worth $8, I don't mind ordering the beer.
You know, I guess if you were, like, you know, looking for a cheap, not really happy hour, I guess, you could, like, show up to the game late, you know, go there to the, you know, watch the end of the game, and then go to this little bar up there, get some cheap brews.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a bad way to do things.
Just as a pro tip out there.
Anybody, if you live in Pittsburgh,
yeah,
this is our tip to craft beer drinking.
You can probably get tickets for pretty cheap after the game starts, I would think.
one would imagine.
So this should be a no-brainer. And I'm just, you know, it's the kind of pro tips that we give out here.
Yeah, well, and what also would be a no-brainer?
Yeah. Is, you have another pro tip for people?
Yeah, when you're sitting on the first baseline, sure, and you have the chance to nab a ball,
right?
You go ahead and do it. Yeah. And you've got to do it the manly way, with your hand. Like, gloves are not allowed. If you're a grown man, not allowed to have a glove.
Yeah.
But there are other things that can make this more interesting. One of those things is cradling your infant child in your arm.
Yes. And my pro tip would be actually, don't try to catch the ball in that situation. Even if you are a man. It's a little bit late, but we were talking about, it was right around the time we watched the game, actually, was, this guy, thought it'd be, it really is impressive. If you haven't, seen this and know what we're talking about, this, where was this? In Chicago?
Yeah, it was in Chicago. One of the fans, and I mean, he did end up, causing an out because he reached over into the field of play.
Right. That was the first thing he did wrong.
That was pretty clear. But, yeah, he has his child in his left hand, and he ends up reaching over, and, I mean, he's on top of the...
Guy was right there to catch the ball, which is...
Yeah, I didn't notice how close it was until they did, like, the third replay, and it was from a different angle, and it showed how perfectly the guy's mitt was right underneath his hand.
It looked like they were posing for a picture, like, well, the one picture I saw. Like, they're both leaning in. The one guy has the baby. His other hand where he has the baby is, like, outstretched. Like, and the kid is, like, and he has the bottle in the kid's mouth still. I literally don't know how he did it.
Yeah, I mean, do not have much experience in worrying about feeding a child.
This is like, yeah, for me, this is like that scene from Anchorman where the dog tells him that he ate the whole wheel of cheese.
When Baxter eats the whole wheel of cheese.
Yeah. He's like, I'm not even mad.
I'm impressed.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to at least be impressed that he did pull this off. I mean, for God's sakes, there's a million ways that could have gone wrong.
Yeah, and I did enjoy when Don Mattingly, the manager of the LA Dodgers, came out to protest the call because they had just called it, you know, a strike, and they... You know, the guy was going to be allowed to continue his at-bat.
Oh, they called it a foul.
Yeah, they just called it a foul ball. And he came out to argue it and got the replay. And everyone in the state, I mean, they were in Chicago.
Yeah.
So, you know, everyone started booing. But it did amuse me that everyone started booing because it became... Like, I thought it the first time I saw the clip, but it became pretty obvious the second time they showed it, even before Mattingly, I think, started to complain about it, you know, that he had clearly been in the field of play.
Right. Yeah, he reached over the wall. I mean, I think it might have hit the wall. Well, I don't know. If it hits, like, the top of the wall, what is that? What does that count as?
You've got to allow the player to play the ball.
I see.
So, even if it hit on top of the wall, like, if he has a chance to snag that, you've got to allow him that chance.
Because he could actually reach over the wall and catch the ball, and that would be okay, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and obviously it happens there more than it does in the outfield, although the infamous... guy,
Bartman, was that his name?
Yeah, Steve Bartman was in the outfield.
Yeah.
But I feel like I see it far more often when people are snagging, ricochets off of, you know, the side of the walls, because, I mean, the baseball fans are really, like, I mean, a lot of them are, like, close to on the field.
Right.
You know,
with some of the seating.
Yeah, basketball kind of has some of those areas. And baseball definitely has them, too. I don't feel like the NFL doesn't have them in any way. Like, football doesn't have them in any way.
Yeah. Why don't they let you keep the football if it goes in the stands? What do you think that's all about? Or, like, they don't flip footballs up to people in the stands.
Well, they get fined for it.
I know. Or
for a celebration. But, so, I mean, people do that. But it's not like in soccer where even if a guy scores and kicks it into the crowd, you're still supposed to throw it back. Like, in that situation, if a football player throws it into the stands, you're allowed to keep that.
Oh, yeah?
I think so. Because isn't that why they get fined?
I
guess that's why I assumed that they got fined is because...
Yeah, because they don't have enough money in the NFL to buy balls.
Naturally.
That's the problem.
Making billions of dollars is not enough to cover for one $50 ball.
Right, they can't afford it. It's impossible.
Can't find room in the budget, Ken.
I mean, if you did that, I would say that would give people a reason to go to games instead of watching it at home on their... HD TVs and the recliners with, you know, cheap beer
that they got from PNC Park the night before.
Yeah. They just poured it into like a false leg. Yeah. These are all free of charge pro tips, you know. And actually, I should say they are at your own risk. We're not going to assume any liability for attempting any of these.
Pro tips,
yes.
Because we cannot assure that you are a pro.
It's true. And some people would say, hey, Ken, Kevin, what are you guys doing giving out these pro tips to people? You don't know if they're pros. Well, I feel like you guys deserve it. And, we're not going to make that call. You guys, everyone's going
to
have to make...
If they're not on our level, we want to bring them up to our level.
Yes, yes.
So we want other pros out there.
We're not about being elitist here. We're just telling people the info.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that was a one sporting event that happened recently, I guess, Kevin.
Right. Another one, definitely a favorite subject of ours, although it's not usually about the actual play. Soccer. Like, we have... focused on the brass of FIFA.
Yeah.
We have talked about individuals like Lionel Messi.
Oh, just an update. I did recently see a headline that said that Sepp Blatter said he was totally innocent and is going to go to heaven someday.
Oh, I wish I had seen that. That's outstanding.
So, that's just a little update if you guys are following along with that story.
So
that's good. I'm glad to hear that. But
Well, he did not pop his head up at the Women's World Cup.
No. He for some reason wasn't there. But who was there? The U.S. team and the Japan team from Japan were there. Mostly.
Although. It did dawn on me, and maybe it's just because I was finishing up making a oatmeal milk stout and doing a little bit of cleaning.
Oh, yeah, I actually happened to be over at your house when this was going on.
Right, and you were giving us not some play-by-play, but you were screaming when the goals were being scored.
Yes.
And each time I did not believe you.
I was doing my terrible Spanish soccer announcer, you know, yelling out goal when they would score. And I think I scared you guys the first time I did it, so I might have stopped after that.
But, yeah, but you had to keep on cheering because the goals came often and quickly. Was within the opening 15 minutes they were up 4-0, the United States. And really, the coup de grace of this was the video that that you sent, which was Carly Lloyd's approximately 54-yard strike.
Right.
And it did remind me, and I was and I guess I didn't realize it because I wasn't really watching it, how crazy the shadows were for the Japanese at that point. Because there was some giant tower on the stadium that was casting a shadow just kind of on the middle and right-hand side of the field. And just, again, from more of a baseball perspective, there are a lot of times where people make a big deal when the batter is in the dark and the pitcher is in the light, or vice versa.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it's harder for the batter to pick up the ball, and sometimes it's easier for them. I can't remember which order that is. But they had just mentioned how much the Japanese may have had problems with the odd lighting. And I mean, where Carly Lloyd kicked the ball, she was in the shadows, and then it went into light, and then back into shadows, and then back into the light. And it might have been honestly, because I did see this one, if the woman hadn't slipped, I think she makes the save. The woman goalie
yes.
for Japan, if she doesn't slip, to me, she makes the save.
Even with, like, slipping as she did a, you know, a decent job of, like, trying to get a hand on the ball and moving it out of the way. So you're probably right.
Yeah, but I mean, she still almost got it out of there.
Yeah.
Like, because she deflected it enough, so because it was going to be a pretty clear goal, but, I mean, she made it hit off the post and then go in. So, I mean, she did a pretty decent job. If she keeps her footing for even a step longer, I think she has, like, the right angle on it. So, I mean, there were just a lot of things on that goal that went right for Carly Lloyd for that thing to go in. But, I mean, just the fact that she still struck it that well, because it was still over the goalie's head. The goalie still had to be rushing backwards to make the save. I mean, you are really putting the goalie in a pressure situation. With the quality of her hit, just to start with, too. So, I mean, yeah. I don't want to undersell how, I mean, to be able to kick a ball that far and that accurately is extremely hard.
And just to kind of make that split decision that, you know, you see the goalie is way out there.
And that you can actually attempt this.
Yeah.
Like, because most of the times you're just like, you're just giving the ball back to the other team? Like, you know, you do really have to pick the right situation to execute that move.
Yeah, exactly. But I think she did see what the situation was there. But yeah, that was her third goal. So it's not, I feel like it's pretty rare to see someone get a hat trick in soccer. Is that accurate?
They're not entirely rare, but in a game of that magnitude, the scores do tend to be a little bit lower because both teams are very good, which means that they, even if one phase, like the defense, is weaker than the offense, you know, a good offense can help negate, you know, the bad defense, or right. can kind of help disguise it. So, I mean, they tend to be lower scoring games. So, I mean, even the fact that this was a 5-2 game is something of an anomaly.
In a World Cup final.
Yeah, in a World Cup final, whether it's the women or the men, like, that's just a lot of goals to be. 7 goals is a lot of goals.
Wow, yeah. And I just, you know, I don't know if you really watched any of the game or not, but, you were kind of cooking dinner in the other room.
Well, by the time I started watching, it was the second half.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, they kind of made a push. That second goal made it 4-2. And then the U.S. scored to go up 5-2. And I mean, if there was some inkling of a comeback, and not sure that there completely was.
Yeah, that was pretty much gone by that point.
Yeah, the 5-2 was really the final nail in the coffin, and I mean, there was still plenty of time left in the match. So they were actually, and I mean, I read some of the women are just like, they're like, we need to play this out. Like, we can't like get too crazy about this. Right. Like, it was one of those cognizant things that they're just like, oh my God, we can't. Like, I mean, they were as surprised as anyone. You know, I mean, you've got to have confidence going into those things, but
they weren't expecting to go up like
4-0 in the first 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think anyone in any sport expects it to happen that easily at that, you know, that kind of a stage.
Because that would be maybe equivalent to like a 30-0 football score, would you say?
Well, I would say that, yeah, at least 21-0 at the end of the first quarter.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
that would be pretty brutal.
Right. Well, yeah. And maybe not even the end of the first quarter. Like, what, they're 15 minutes, so the first, like, 12 minutes, you're up 21-0 or 28-0.
Oh, right. Yeah. So that's pretty bad there.
Yeah, you're just like, okay, what do I do for the rest of the game now?
Yeah, if you're Bill Belichick, you're still running your first string offense and throwing deep balls, but
those
Patriots. But yeah, I don't know. It was just interesting to me to watch. I mean, I hadn't really been watching the women's team, but apparently they weren't doing as well. And I think they were using Abby Wambach more. I don't know if you're familiar with any of these players.
I'm fairly familiar with the team, I guess. And I did not watch... I watched less of this Women's World Cup than I have most of them. I mean, because it's another thing where... I mean, I'll just watch sports. Like, I don't really care if it's male or female. I don't mind flipping it on, especially when it's this kind of pressure and that kind of skill. Like, yeah. I mean, I love watching, because you don't get anything like this, but women's Olympic hockey is a blast to watch.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. But I'll say, like, they just looked like total badasses out there for, like, the part of the game I watched, at least. It was just, like, they were going out there and just, like... driving the ball down their throats and just, you know, getting these goals. I was like, wow.
Yeah, they obviously took it quite to them.
So, yeah, that was pretty cool to watch. It was, you know, a fun event. I don't know. I mean, that Carly Lloyd had a hell of a game there.
Right. So. Yeah, she, and I think she's just about done after this one, too. And she was the captain, so, I mean, it was, you know, I think she was. But, yeah, that's just kind of a big moment. Three, you know, a hat trick in a World Cup final is quite impressive.
Yeah.
And, like I said, like, the first goal that she scored was really impressive because she just darted into the box and found a nice empty space. Like, she just beat someone to space.
I think I read that one was like a set, what do they call those?
Set piece.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, but it seemed like it worked out pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, that thing worked to perfection then. I mean, if it was that much of a set piece, I mean... she just beat her defender who was there, but she, I mean, she just beat her to the spot, got the ball, and rifled it in.
Yeah.
She
just seemed like kind of like she was running from about 30 yards away, maybe, and then got there right when the ball was
at the perfect there. Position.
And then didn't really do it, just like hauled off and nailed it. Basically, that was the first touch of the ball, I would say.
Yeah, that was a nice one timer, I would say. Mm-hmm. And then the second one, like I said before we started the show, like, to me, it's a garbage goal, at least in hockey terms. She was in the right place at the right time, and she put it in. Like, just the skill to put that in is still not easy. Right. Like, there are plenty of people that still mess up a goal that is gifted to them.
Maybe you're not necessarily ready for the ball to be bouncing the way it is. And you just, you know, it's like reaction time, you know?
Yeah, sometimes you can just airball on it. Like, you're in the right spot, you just, unfortunately, it's not completely stable, so you whiff a little bit.
Yeah.
But she did not whiff, and she put it in. Yes. And then, yeah, that was the, as I said, the coup de grace, the 54-yard strike.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I felt really bad for the Japanese goalie there. It was just pretty brutal looking. And you're right. I definitely noticed there was these big shadows on the field. And the field looked like, I mean, in general, the field looked like it was from 1986, I think.
And I believe we covered that complaint too.
Yeah.
Which was the bad playing surface for the women's games.
And it was like that shadow that the big shadow on the field reminded me of like older games for some reason. Like, I feel like this happened at older stadiums, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, it does. I feel like they've tried to solve that problem.
Yeah, because I guess they realize it messes up the games. Because it seems like it doesn't happen as much.
Right.
You know, maybe we'll throw this one out as a poll for our listeners. I don't know, it's been a while since we did a poll.
I think it's a perfect poll.
Yeah. Do you think that they're building stadiums now so that they don't have shadows on the field from the sun?
Yep. Simple yes or no question. Yeah.
Straight up and down. I guess it could be, what would be the third option here? Yes, no, I don't give a F, I think.
Yes. Well, it's funny that you should say that, Ken.
Oh, should I?
Yes, because there is Dragon Ball Z Resurrection F.
Oh, as in, yes, F.
Mm-hmm. As in Frieza.
So, we are, of course, fans of Dragon Ball Z.
Yes, this has been mentioned a couple of times, I believe.
Yeah, so deal with it.
That's my line, and you usually get offended when I use it.
Oh, well, look at that. I guess turned it around there. Maybe I'm reappropriating.
I'm so good, you're just stealing my shit, Ken.
Yeah, well, you know what? I guess you gotta watch out. I should have footnoted that one for you there. Sorry, I didn't mean to take credit. But yeah, so I was gonna make some segue based on Carly Lloyd having gone Super Saiyan during that game, but there's more than one way to skin a cat, you know.
Oh man. Well, yeah, this clip though of Resurrection F was the second of two that you sent me. The first one was of
a new series.
Yeah, a new series called Dragon Ball Super, which is and it is kind of interesting because they jumped ahead in time really far after Frieza died.
For the new series, Dragon Ball Super? Is that what you're saying?
Or
for the movie?
No. Because isn't this... is this after Frieza? The Dragon Ball Super...
Yes, it is. It's picking up right at the after Majin Buu.
After Majin Buu.
Yes, that's when Dragon Ball Super is picking up.
But didn't they jump ahead to like Super Space Dragon Ball?
Well, you know what? That's like a non-canon Dragon Ball, and I'm glad we're getting into this here.
We're really geeking out on the Dragon Ball Z mythos.
Yeah, if you wanted some Dragon Ball Z talk, here you go. I guess people know. We tell people what we're talking about here, so they shouldn't be surprised. But so there was Dragon Ball first, of course, young Goku. Then we went to Dragon Ball Z. And people are familiar with that. Then they did Dragon Ball GT in Japan. And I guess here too. Probably. But it was a little wacko, and like they ended up going like having like a chase the dragon around the universe or something like that, and like collect these like super galaxy dragon balls or something that were like scattered all over the place, and then like,
yeah, well, of course, I mean, why not,
going like Super Saiyan 4 where they grow a tail again and get like a weird,
hey, I like the they turned into, didn't they turn into Gold Were-Ape?
Oh, I think that was like a step in the process to becoming Super Saiyan 4, but yeah.
That was kind of cool looking. I've got to admit, that just should have been Super Saiyan 4. A Golden Were-Ape is, I mean, that's kind of cool. I'm just throwing it out there.
And you've always said that.
I stuck with that. I mean, of all the ridiculousness that they threw out on that, because I don't remember really watching it, but I do remember seeing multiple clips of Dragon Ball GT. That was one of the things that did draw my attention.
Yeah, because it, you know, you got the people that turn into the giant ape that's like, what, 10 stories tall?
Yes, it was very Kong. Enormous.
Yeah, King Kong sort of thing. But then that's not quite enough. So then you've got to get golden hair, turn gold. And then after that, I think you turn into, like...
Yeah, and then you weird... have Saiyan, flying Saiyan powers on top of this.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
It's a 10-story tall golden ape.
You can fly, you can probably shoot energy beams, I'm thinking.
Yeah, I'm gonna guess that Rampage would look very, you know...
Oh, that would be a very fun game, different. Though, if you had, like, a Rampage version of Dragon Ball, like... You could be Goku or Vegeta, and then, like, you start out, and then you turn into, like, your big Were-Ape form.
Yeah. I'd be down with that.
Okay. Well, maybe we can make that happen.
We'll sell it to Toonami.
Yeah. I'm sure that Toei would have no problem with that, seeing as how they did remove the one video for from YouTube that we were trying to... talk about here today, but
yeah, the Dragon Ball Super trailer has been removed, which was I did get to watch it this morning, but somewhere in between this morning and this evening has rendered this useless.
Yeah, so that seemed like it just picked up right after the events of well, if not right after, at least it's going to pick up after the Buu saga in Dragon Ball Z.
Yeah, and I've got to admit, I was not all that in on the Majin Buu thing. Like, I know that I've seen some stuff from it. I've probably seen more than I haven't, actually, but I'm not sure I saw that through to completion.
Yeah, it's, there's a lot of, kind of, I don't know, weird stuff going on there. I mean... The bad guy starts turning people into candy at one point and eating them. I don't know if you remember that going on.
Oh, I think so.
Yeah.
I'm trying not to.
It's a little weird. I mean, there was one memorable scene, at least, where later on in the story, Goku and Vegeta used together to become one fighter.
Yeah, I do remember that. But they still couldn't beat Majin Buu, and eventually it was Gohan that beat him, correct?
It ended up being Goku. You're thinking of Cell that Gohan defeated. Yeah, it ended up being him then, but
okay.
Yeah, it Majin Buu was knocked out by Goku, but he needed a spirit bomb with, like, all the energy from everyone from Earth. So they had to, like, everybody on Earth had to actually raise their hands to give him the energy. It wasn't like before where he would just kind of, like, passively take off the energy from the Earth.
Right.
So, but people didn't want to do it until, of course, Mr. Satan told everybody to do it, and then they recognized his voice and obeyed him because, of course, he saved them from Cell. The first time around, according to popular wisdom. I guess.
Oh, I do actually remember that weirdness.
Yeah. That was a great name, Mr. Satan, by the way. I don't know. That's like an only in Japan sort of thing.
Oh, man. So what else? The Resurrection F. So, I mean, we haven't really addressed that.
Sure. Now, we talked about the series Dragon Ball Super, but this Resurrection F is a feature film. And now, then the films kind of operate in their own universe, I feel like.
Yeah, because they put this as it a little bit of a... They put this almost before Majin Buu. Or also right after Majin Buu, one of the two.
Yeah, it looked like it had an older Gohan, actually, so I don't know. Did he seem to have a little bit of a gray hair to you, or is that just me imagining things?
Goku had gray hair, or Gohan?
Gohan.
That's right, he's not complete Saiyan.
Right, he's a half Saiyan, and I do believe that they've said... I believe it's canon that full-blooded Saiyans don't actually really show signs of aging until they're almost, like, ready to kick the bucket.
Oh, okay.
So, that would be why Goku may not have dark hair, or may still have dark hair, but his son actually might have gray hair.
Gotcha.
So, I don't know. Maybe I was imagining it, but it seemed like he might have had his hair may have been lightening a little bit.
Gotcha. Yeah,
which, seeing as how the story started when he was about 5 years old, it's kind of funny at this point. Because it probably has literally been that long since this thing started.
Yeah, because a lot of these sagas took years.
Yeah.
Like, they were not short-lasting things. I mean, that was one thing. I mean, it never felt like it watching the cartoon, but they did kind of inform you that it took longer than... Because how many months at a time did they spend in, who was it, it's not Konami.
Toei? You mean...
The room that you spent, 2 hours in it, but it was actually 3 years or something crazy like that?
Okay, yeah, I think you could spend a day in there and it would be a year, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, that's it.
It was, I think they called it the hyperbolic time chamber in the English version.
Correct.
Or the room of spirit and time in the Japanese version. But depends if which version, I guess, you want to go with there.
But, okay. Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, they spent a lot of time in there. Like, it felt like...
The Frieza fight alone, speaking of Frieza... lasted for a good 48 hours of real time, I feel like. That was pretty long, famously. So I didn't really see the runtime of this movie, because Frieza is coming back, apparently.
Right. That is the Resurrection F part, is for Frieza.
Looked like some goober wished him back to life, and I don't know who that was. Or why he did that. But it's a pretty dumb move, I would say.
Yeah, I would not say this person is the sharpest knife in the drawer.
Because it doesn't seem like he was around for the rest of the movie, so...
As he should not be. He should probably be dead.
But they're, I guess, going to posit the idea that Frieza became stronger somehow when he came back.
They clearly showed in this preview, and this one, put out by, Konami.
Yes, the official, well, Toei, maybe.
And Toei.
Yeah. This is the official trailer. I think we'll be able to link to it.
Correct. Yes. Yeah, this one is linkable, the other one is dead.
It looked pretty cool.
There were some cool parts to it. There's other parts of me that just goes, they're just bringing back kind of the main arch enemy just to do it. And it does make sense, like, depending upon what time frame they put this in, like, Goku himself is, like, way more of a badass. From the point that he did beat Frieza, like, he found another level of Super Saiyan.
Oh, right. Yeah, he's moved on, like, two levels since Frieza. Yeah.
Right. So it's just like, well, what did Frieza have to move up to? In the meantime, to start to compete with this guy who's just a supreme ass kicker, really.
Yeah, it seemed that he had reached a new Frieza, and that he had like a new final form that he turned into. But he had like golden armor, I guess, like a Super Saiyan for Frieza, maybe.
Yeah. And I don't know, it just seems kind of crazy to me. Like, it just seems a little played out. Like, I kind of understand the theory, because I do believe that you once told me that Frieza was supposed to really be the end of the series.
Yeah.
You know, that was supposed to be it, but it was so popular that they ended up extending it.
Yeah, I mean, it makes perfect sense, because Frieza is, like, really, from the beginning of what they call Dragon Ball Z, where Goku finds out he's a Saiyan and, you know, meets his brother and fights with Vegeta, like, all that stuff is leading up to Frieza. Like, he's kind of like the guy who is really behind everything, you know, the guy who kind of made Vegeta into what he was, you know, kind of like, although I don't think Vegeta was ever going to be a humanitarian or anything.
No, he always seemed like a bit of an asshole, yeah. Which made him completely charming all the time.
He mellows out, I think, later in life. But
yeah, Bulma calms him down.
But so Frieza is really the end of all that, it seems like to me.
Yeah, so I mean, I kind of understand, like, you're trying to bring back, like, the greatest foe. Mm-hmm. So I mean, and I don't think I would turn down watching it, I guess. But I don't know if I'd rush out too if it's just kind of in the theater for a limited time.
Yeah. If it was 3D, that might make me want to go. But I would go and sort of, like, be kicking myself at the same time. If that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it does to me.
But I feel like there's a chance I might get enough enjoyment out of it to justify the ticket price. I'm not saying it's going to change my life or anything, but it could be just, like, something entertaining enough to watch. Like, some of the scenes of, like, Krillin flying through the woods and, like, blowing up all those henchmen, which seems like a really pointless attack. if you guys aren't familiar,
I did enjoy even how what's his name, the lizard man, he was Piccolo.
I don't know if he's a lizard, maybe more like a slug, if anything. He's got those weird little antenna thing that stick out.
But I mean, like, he's one of those characters that even to me, by the time Frieza was done, he was such a useless character.
In terms, like, of strength, yeah.
Yeah, in terms of strength, like, he was a big hurdle in Goku's development.
I think with the exception of there was a time during the Cell fight where he was actually strong enough to take on Cell, if you remember that.
Because didn't he take on somebody else of...
Yes, he merged with Kami, of course. Former Guardian of the Earth. Keeper of the Dragon Balls. So, yeah, when he merged with Kami, the Dragon Balls were gone. I mean, that was, like, the reason for the show. Until they got Dende to come down and be the new Guardian, make his own Dragon Balls, everybody's happy. Except for, I mean, Dende's by himself, though. I guess that's kind of... big deal for him. But, oh well. He became the God of Earth, so, I mean, that's pretty good.
right. So, yeah, Piccolo, I kind of did forget he at least added some badass points there.
Mm, yes.
Because I thought he merged with somebody else from his clan, too.
Yeah, that was Nail. Namek, the the last of the warrior Namics, because everybody else was just a bunch of farmers. yeah, you know, that's just to go a little deep dive here, a little Dragon Ball Z pro tip of sorts. Although I don't know what you can do with this. Back on we said Piccolo, he's this green guy, right? You described him as
kind of looks like a slug. Yeah. Yes, slug lizard.
Yeah, but it turns out that he came from originally came from a planet of slug lizard people as well, and that's where they fought Frieza, the big bad guy. The final showdown happened there.
Yeah, and the planet got destroyed.
That's true.
Yeah, so...
But, my point was that actually, I don't know why I know this, but, like, they had some type of, natural disaster on Namek, and that is what, killed off just about everybody. And so, like, at this time, like, Namek was just sort of, like, coming back, and, like, they were replanting all these fields. That's why, like, most of the planet was, like...
Empty.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there was they didn't have really any more of the like the warrior type people. Like that one guy Nail was really like the last
that
guy.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. But and so
last of the samurai. And last everybody of the Mohicans.
Everybody and I think everybody who was there was actually descended from the Great Namek, because Namek's there's no like female Namek's. They have sex asexually, or well, they reproduce asexually. How can you? I guess you couldn't really have sex asexually. That would be tricky. Anyway, a little bit about Namek anatomy, physiology, history, climatology. You know, we come at it from all angles here.
Yeah, well, talking about coming at it from all angles, Ken.
I like where this is going.
And climatology and weather and blood and sweat and tears. There was a very interesting story about Featherball that you sent me from ESPN. And I'm trying to remember which exact thing covered it here for ESPN.
Yeah, it might have been the magazine or something.
Right.
Something like that.
And it was feather bowling.
Feather bowling is the sport. And I had never, ever heard of this before.
Right. And I guess after I read that it was supposed to be about this one guy, I was a little confused by the writing, to be completely honest with you, Ken. This happens to me, frequently, that I feel like, some writers get off topic.
Yeah, this one took me a while to, like, try to understand, what was going on. And it wasn't the easiest of reads, I guess. But I was just sort of intrigued by this little group of people who are kind of keeping this sport alive, really,
And that was the one thing that I felt was really lacking in the article. They kept on mentioning how a lot of the iconography in this bar and in this... they have these two lanes in this rundown bar in Detroit.
Yes, which is a city that's rundown.
Right. And all of the iconography in it is Belgian. Yet all of the Belgian people that that they talked to back in the old country have no idea what this sport is about.
Yes. The sport is called feather bowling, and I guess
yeah,
it's kind of like bocce ball, I guess you could say.
They said it was kind of a bocce ball meets the one in the Winter Olympics?
Curling.
Curling.
Yeah, similar to that, because they have these
Yeah, because they have these discs, wooden discs.
That they kind of look like cheese wheels, like little cheese wheels.
Well, I would not call those little. They look like they have some pretty substantial size to them.
Yeah, I guess they're not like the big, like, they're huge cheese wheels, but...
Yeah, they're, well, and they're not 16-pound bowling balls, I don't think, either.
No, yeah. But they roll, I guess, unevenly. They said that they are, like, weighted a certain way so that they... they don't just like roll smoothly.
Right. And, the course itself, usually you want a pristine, smooth surface. This is not, warranted in feather bowling.
Yeah. It's just like they said, there's no floor underneath it. Like this is just from when these people came over and they dug a trench in the ground. And then, what, build a building over it? There's, like,
Right, yeah, because it's downstairs from the main floor of the bar.
Oh, okay, yeah. Gotcha. So that's, like, in the basement.
Though. Yeah, it's in the basement. And, Like I said, I didn't realize that this was more of a portrait about the one guy. Because they just went... I feel like there's about five main sections to this article... And two of the five did not deal with this guy at all.
Yeah, it was talking about, I think, the sport itself, which I think that I do believe the article said there's only four of these lanes outside of Belgium, I believe, in the world. Like, this is not a
Is it actually a thing in Belgium? Because everyone in the article said that they pretty much couldn't confirm anything in Belgium.
They said there was a few... there's like... one area where they had, you know, several of these lanes in Belgium.
Oh, okay.
So it wasn't like a thing in the all of Belgium even. It was just like kind of like one area.
Yeah, very specific area. Okay.
And they also said that the lanes that they had there were like kind of like AstroTurf, like real smooth and like not at all like what they were doing in Detroit. Which was kind of interesting because I guess they, you know, if you think about it, like they probably used to do it that way just because, you know, it was like
that's all you could do.
Yeah. Yeah. But, as right. things progressed, they kind of, were able to make them nicer and nicer. And then they did that. But it was interesting that these people in Detroit were really just about like keeping it always the same, I guess. Like just keeping it. Connecting, I guess, with some, the way things used to be, maybe.
Yeah, there was, and I mean, I guess that was another thing that I just felt like it was, I would be kind of interested in what compelled these guys to keep on doing this sport.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's one of those passions that, there are a bunch of weird passions out there. And, yeah. This one would fall under, into that area.
And pretty much everybody was saying that when they're playing this, you know, there's skill involved, but a lot of it comes down to luck because you need to have things go the certain way. And, you know, it's a dirt ditch, you know, basically that changes with time, like water can flow through or whatever, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, they were just talking. Well, yeah, it's a basement.
Yeah. I mean, it's the ground, really. Yeah. So, like, I guess... you know, would maybe sometimes rocks can come up, you know, from the ground. And...
yeah. Well, you've got to be wearing it out, just throwing a wooden sphere or whatever you want to call the object.
Wooden cheese wheel. Yeah. That's wooden, what I would like to call it.
Wooden cheese wheel. you know, I mean, that's going to do damage to the floor. Like cause it's almost got to be, things have got to change from season to season, just depending upon how people throw.
Right.
And how things get hit, depending upon the impact, or the direction of the impact.
Mm-hmm.
So
and it's kind of the sorry to interrupt you there.
Okay.
But the lanes kind of have like a bowl-like quality to it. Like the sides are raised.
Certainly.
So they use that sometimes to even go back and forth, you know, like a skater on a half pipe or something, you know, going down the mountain there.
Yeah, and I mean, it was kind of interesting that that did not seem like a favored technique. Because the one guy was told that he was getting lucky because he was getting too many bank shots.
Yes, you know, the kind of the guy that is sort of the main character here, I guess.
Oh, okay. Was that him? That, like, because I was a little bit confused just because they talked about a couple of the guy's shooting techniques.
Yes.
Within the article. And again, that's why I didn't realize when they talked at the end of the article, the one gentleman dies.
Yeah, it's a bit spoiler alert, I guess, if you haven't read it. I mean, it is. I felt like it was an interesting story just because it was weird that these people. It makes you just, I guess, wonder, like, why it was that they were all kind of coming together and doing this crazy sport.
Yeah, and it wasn't like everyone seemed to come there for different reasons at different times, and you weren't just included in this group to play this sport. Like, you almost needed an invitation from one of the guys that was already playing.
Yeah, that's
to what get it seems you like. Into the league,
right? Because I guess you have to. Yeah, and there was
you have to be Detroit-y enough.
It was like a secret society of some kind, you know, it seems like.
Right, yeah, I mean, that's why, I mean, I really wanted more. Like, it was really fascinating. And, I mean, I think that's why I feel like it was a little scattered a bit. It's just like, it kind of touched on some topics that, to me, have way more interest to me.
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying.
That weren't covered. Like, maybe it's just that I was disappointed that there wasn't more as an overall whole.
I mean, this seems like it should be a movie at some point, or it could be a movie.
Yeah, and I did not get a chance. Jeremy was not feeling well today, so I did not talk to him. I'll have to see if he ever did a little bit of feather bowling.
Oh, yeah, because he was from around that area, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
I feel like it's not. It's still, even in Detroit, not something that like everybody has heard of.
Yeah, it seems pretty exclusive to a small group of people
from a small country, and it really is a small area inside that small country, which is kind of really the funny part. I don't know.
Yeah, because they were talking about how a lot of them, a lot of the Belgian immigrants. And I mean, again, something that maybe could have been talked about a little bit more, but the Belgian immigrants kind of came into this area, Detroit, and just kind of expected to pass through, but didn't end up passing through. And it's just like, well, if you made some money and you wanted to go elsewhere, wouldn't you keep going? Like, well, I mean, even that part was kind of interesting, but I mean, maybe they were just content and they decided to stay.
Yeah, they didn't expect to like it, but then they ended up liking it. So,
yeah.
Why should they go anywhere else, I guess?
Again, something else to look into that, I mean, was just a little curious. I mean, in some ways, it was almost a footnote in this article.
Yeah.
But the Belgians did stick around, or even,
kept their Belgium-ness, it seems like, because they had, like, Belgian flags and things like that in this bar, right?
Right, yeah. It was all the ends of the lane have them, and I guess they were even talking about how they were painting like the Belgian painters. Like this one of the guys in the group, it was pretty crazy. He was he's a courtroom artist.
Oh yeah, this was one of the guys who kind of like became a part of the group.
Right.
Yeah, he was a painter and a courtroom artist. Yeah.
Yeah, and he even did some paintings for Thomas Hearns versus Sugar Ray Leonard.
Oh, yeah, boxing matches. Right.
Yeah, for a boxing match, you know, and he did some famous court cases, quite a number of famous court cases. That part was kind of, and I mean, again.
Well, yeah, because this was the guy who would, at the end of every year, they would have a champion for that year. And this guy would do a portrait of the champion, and then they would hang that on the wall as kind of their Hall of Fame there.
Right, and he even went back and did former past champions.
That's right, yeah. So they had pictures of people. He would do portraits of them with paint. So, yeah, they ended up this kind of oddball character who they say was getting lucky to win. He got his painting done. And then
weirdly enough, it got stolen.
Yeah, someone stole it from the bar.
Like, I mean, it's kind of crazy that they just decided to swipe one.
Right.
Like, again, seems like a bigger mystery to me.
Yeah.
And the fact that it was weird that some stranger came up to this gentleman's door with his own sketch of how the new painting should look, but the old painter ended up redoing the portrait anyway. There was just, like, that story is just like, oh, well, that's kind of interesting, but I still have some questions about this. Like, what happened to that guy's sketch? Like, why did it get turned down?
I wonder if...
Like, it cheered and the gentleman that died, he had a couple of different cancer diagnoses.
Yeah, that's right.
And it just kind of kept on getting worse.
And he seemed like an interesting character because he lived in, like, this old, 19th century farmhouse, they said.
Correct. That was
in the city there. He definitely seemed like a guy who was kind of... And I don't even know... I mean, he may have been Belgian, but it just seemed like he was a guy who was kind of into, like, old stuff, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, that seemed to be more his fascination than the Belgian part.
Yeah.
And he just kind of liked this old thing. Like, he kind of liked all the things old about Detroit. He liked to go, and I guess I didn't realize that they did... they do a super old car show up in Detroit that he always went to.
Yeah, yeah, Model Ts and stuff.
Well, and they were talking about how they had models before T, like A through...
up to S, I
guess. S.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was just like, something that... I guess I know more about car shows now in some ways, just because I have at least some friends that are interested in it. But still kind of a relatively new subject for me. So I was kind of fascinated by that, too. But, I mean, it was something that was a little bit glossed over. Is used as more of a background for what he was doing in... To reinforce his kind of old schoolness, as we're talking about, which helped kind of get him into this group for this weird feather bowling league.
And I don't think we talked about the actual feather, but there is a feather at each end of the lane, which acts as a target that you're trying to get your cheese
wheel
down to. Yes, I guess Belgians are into cheese, right? That kind of makes sense.
Yeah, they're into cheese and beer.
Oh, well, and it's a bar, so that makes perfect sense.
It's a bar, yep.
But, yeah, I mean, this story should be a movie. I feel like the kind of weird thing about the article is that, like, some of the stuff, it doesn't just come out and say some of the stuff. Like, you kind of have to think about it a little bit afterwards, almost. Like,
oh, okay.
Because, he doesn't really say, like, he just tells you, like, what this guy does, and, like, it's kind of all this weird stuff. And then, like... You know, I don't know, but it's a long read, but you know what? It's out there for free if you're someone who likes reading interesting stories.
Yeah, it's very fascinating. I mean, I liked it a lot. Like I said, I mean, it really left me wanting more. So, and that's not a bad thing. I mean, just because I think it was kind of constructed poorly isn't the isn't a completely bad thing. I mean, it was kind of fascinating. I like these kind of weird groups in the U.S.
Yeah, like we were saying, you're friends with weirdos. So
yeah, that was set off air.
Yeah,
I do have a friend who literally has the words "Last Call" tattooed across his neck, and he is serving his last adult beverage here in just over a week.
So
July 19th, he quits being a bartender.
Does he have something else lined up, or?
I do not know exactly, because I don't really talk to him that much.
Yeah, well.
Well, he doesn't reply to me that much, I guess, is probably a better way to put it.
Best of luck to him.
Yep.
In his new,
whatever his adventures. Whatever his new adventures are. But you know what, Ken? We're still drinking quality.
That's true.
Craft beer.
Yeah, and we have another couple. We have actually had a pair of local beers here this evening.
Yes, we did, because I went to Actual Brewing, which is not too far from your homestead.
You actually went there.
Yeah. And I actually went to Homestead Brewing recently too.
Oh.
This past Saturday, but I forgot to have my Columbus Ale Trail book stamped.
Son of a.
Well, I didn't have it with me tonight. I forgot to get it stamped at Homestead.
Wow.
Separate situations. So
you're really screwing the pooch with this stamp thing here.
Yeah, I'm screwing the pooch with the stamp thing, but I'm hitting it up with the beers.
Yeah, well, that's probably as important as the stamp.
Far more important than the stamp. So I had a flight of beers at Actual Brewing waiting for you and your lovely wife to finish up dinner. But I completely went off grid and got their French ale called Eccentricity. And this is what we're still drinking at the current moment.
It's very refreshing, I would say.
Yes, it is a nice, light, summery beer. I think it's better. I had their Photon Lager earlier. I would definitely take this over that. Their Ingenuity, their Lemon Saison is very is good, but I like this one better.
Yeah.
I am glad I got talked into this because they said they only had 4 more bottles of it left. So now they only have 3 more bottles of it left.
That's right. So we're giving a recommendation that's probably going to be hard for people to achieve. But
yeah, well, go out and try anything from Actual Brewing.
Yeah.
They have some good stuff. And they have a literal scientist in their midst helping to make their beer.
Yeah,
so it's pretty cool,
and they get food trucks out there sometimes. It's a little hard to find, but
yeah, they had a Japanese noodle guy out there today.
Oh, sweet! Yeah, use the force and you'll get there.
Exactly,
it's worth it.
And Ken, you got the can near you for beer number 2. So
yes, this was from Hoof Hearted Brewing, also here in Columbus. The it's a double India Pale Ale, clocking in at 10.2% alcohol by volume, south of 11, double IPA. It has a very sinister-looking goat figure with a pentagram.
Yeah, it is just below 11%. I wish it was 10.9. Instead, it's 10.2, which is still quite strong.
Yeah, you're right. It would be considered middle of the road at, what was that, brewery?
Oh, Dry Log.
Dry Log, yes.
In Pittsburgh.
Yes.
yes, which had the, floor of a 7% ABV and a top end of 13.2.
Yeah. So this would be literally right in the middle there. Which that
right.
place,
those pansies
if you,
in Ohio.
Yeah. Yeah. That was pretty intense.
We need our new beer purity law so we can get our beverages up to 15%.
Yeah, I say why not.
Yep, we'll vote it in.
Okay, this is what we've got our agenda worked out for us, and thanks for being here this week, listening to us.
Yep, at Gozer33, at DeFrango11, for the brand at StuntGranny. Everybody, we have had a long and fantastic evening. So.
It's been a fun trip. A long, strange trip, if you will.
Good night.
Peace out.